Last Lord's Day, we began a short series of studies on a sad reality of our fallen world, namely divorce and remarriage. We began with a lecture on the Puritan Confessions on divorce and remarriage, as we are forced to deal with the question as to why our Baptist fathers chose to omit the two paragraphs of the Westminster Confession of Faith on divorce and remarriage when the Second London Confession was written. As I explained last week, I want to be as thorough as possible in this series because the whole question of divorce and remarriage is a reality which we are forced to come to conclusions on based on God's revealed word. So the way I've decided to break this study up over the next several weeks is this way. We've already seen the first section, the Puritan Confessions on Divorce and Remarriage. Today, we're going to be looking at divorce and remarriage under the Sinai Covenant. And then we're going to be looking at divorce and remarriage under the prophets. And then finally, the final category will be divorce and remarriage under Christ and the apostles. So I think that once we get through that, we will have dealt with every text of the scriptures dealing with this subject of both Old and New Testament. The title of my lecture this morning is Divorce and Remarriage Under the Sinai Covenant. There is, of course, the main text of Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4 that we'll be looking at later, but not now, which forms the basis of the controversy over divorce and remarriage between the Pharisees and the Lord Jesus. There are, however, other texts that are also important to consider and which are too often overlooked as to what they reveal and what they imply. And so we're going to be looking at three Old Testament texts this morning, all under the heading of divorce and remarriage under the Sinai Covenant. And the three texts we're going to be looking at are Exodus 21, 7 through 11, Deuteronomy 21, 10 through 14, and finally Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4. Now consider in the first place the value of these texts. We, of course, are no longer under the Sinai Covenant. We are under the New Covenant. That reality, however, does not mean that we read only the New Testament scriptures. For it is the New Testament scriptures that underscore the importance of the Old Testament scriptures. We think, for instance, of what the Apostle Paul says to us in Romans chapter 15 and verse 4. And therein he writes of the Old Testament, he says, "For whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, so that through perseverance and the encouragement of the scriptures we might have hope." And then there are these familiar words, in 2 Timothy 3, 16 and 17, "All scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, so that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work." And so the New Testament scriptures tell us we must not overlook the Old Covenant scriptures, because they are there to teach us. In fact, since we're going to be looking at Old Testament civil law this morning in Deuteronomy and Exodus, it's good to be reminded of what our confession says about these laws, the judicial law. And our confession of faith in chapter 19 and paragraph 4 says this: "To them," that is Israel, "he gave sundry judicial laws, which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging any now by virtue of that institution, their general equity only being of moral use." In other words, our Baptist fathers were saying these Old Testament laws are of some use. They are of some use to teach us principles of general equity. In other words, we can still develop principles of general equity from these Old Testament judicial laws. We can learn truth about God and about common principles of justice and equity from these laws. And I would add that these judicial laws we're going to be looking at today are really an expansion of the seventh commandment. The seventh commandment, which says you shall not commit adultery, finds now all kinds of undergirding of these judicial laws that speak to the issue of marriage and also of divorce. Now, we're going to turn right now to the first of these laws. And so consider in the second place what we can learn from the law regarding a female bondservant. What can we learn from the law regarding a female bondservant in Israel? And the law is found in Exodus 21, 7 through 11. And before I read it, Exodus 21, 7 through 11, let me read to you a quotation from John Calvin on this particular judicial law. Calvin says this, "From this passage, as well as other similar ones, it plainly appears how many vices were of necessity tolerated in this people. It was altogether an act of barbarism that fathers should sell their children for the relief of their poverty. Still, it could not be corrected as might have been hoped." So what Moses is doing in this law is regulating a practice that was already in existence in virtually all the cultures of that age. So Moses is regulating this. He says, here's what must take place. If a father sells his daughter because of financial straits to be a bondservant in another man's home. And here's the law, Exodus 21, 7 through 11. If a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. If she is displeasing in the eyes of her master who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. If he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. If he will not do these three things for her, that is food, clothing, and conjugal rights, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. So here, too, now is a law that regulates a practice already in place. We are confronted herein with the very real problems of poverty. And sometimes poor economic conditions can require, or at least families think that they require, drastic measures. And as I was thinking about this, the kind of conditions that would move a person to say we have to take drastic measures because of the economy, as I was thinking about it this week, I need no think no farther back than my own father. My father was one of eight children, and my grandparents came here from Holland in 1913, exactly 100 years ago, when my grandparents came from Holland to America. And since they were from good Dutch Reformed heritage, their first item of business here in America, that is, of that group of immigrants that came over, the first thing that they did when they got here to America after they settled in and found jobs was to build churches. And as I recall, they built big, beautiful brick churches that you could visit to this day. I have these fond memories of these churches all over the city where I grew up. It was one of the first things the immigrants did when they came over after they got settled, after they got jobs. They built churches. Almost as quickly and deemed to be just as important, they built Christian schools. And they, too, were built solidly of brick, designed for generations to come. My dad, being one of eight kids, went to Eastern Christian School through the eighth grade. That school began by Dutch immigrants in 1892. It's one of the oldest Christian schools in America. And my dad went through Eastern Christian School through eighth grade. And then because it was at the heart of the Great Depression, he was forced to quit school and not go on to high school. And so along with his three other brothers, he got a job, and my dad's job was delivering telegrams for Western Union. And so he pedaled on a bicycle delivering telegrams all over Paterson, New Jersey, and all over the surrounding towns. And you kids who might not know what a telegram was, you know, they did Morse code, you know, dots and dashes from one station to another, and then somebody would put it on a piece of paper, put it in an envelope, give it to the Western Union kid. He'd get on his bicycle, and he'd take it to the person, and the person would be able to get their telegram. Aren't cell phones great? But you see, that this kept my dad in phenomenal shape. You know, as he was, couldn't go to high school, had to quit after only eighth grade, pedal all over the city on a one-speed bicycle delivering Western Union telegrams. He and his brothers had to give to the family 90 cents of every dollar they made. They were allowed to keep 10 cents of every dollar they made because difficult economic times sometimes call for drastic measures. And that was very common as to what was done during the Great Depression. My dad never complained about it, but I often wondered, since he did pretty well in life, I was always amazed at the mathematical problems my dad could just do in his head and just give me an answer of something that he worked out in his head without even having to work with a pencil and a piece of paper. I often wondered what could he have done if he had been able to go on to high school and not just have an eighth grade education and go on to college. But he didn't have the opportunity. Because so many people during the Depression, you know, they had to do what they had to do in order to make ends meet. And this is what we're confronted with in this text of God's Word. Here then is a scenario where a girl has become a bondservant. She's working in the home of another man. And if she became his wife, note what he had to provide and what occurred if he failed to do so. Verses 8 through 11. If she is displeasing in the eyes of her master who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. If he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food. Actually, the Hebrew is flesh, meat. He may not reduce her flesh. The picture is of a well-to-do household. He may not reduce her flesh. He may not reduce her clothing. He may not reduce her conjugal rights. And so here, even for a bondservant, a female bondservant, she had rights. She had the right to food. She had the right to clothing. And she had the right to sexual relations. She had the right to these things. And if he reduced that right or said, no, I'm not providing those things, then she had the right to, quote, go out. And this is divorce. She was a free woman. She was no longer married. If he would not provide these things, she had the right to go out. Now, this then requires us to ask, this is very important. We take a law like this and we say, okay, we're not under this law anymore. We're under the new covenant. But this teaches us principles of general equity. And so what we're required from a text like this, if we're thinking deeply on it, this requires us to ask, for instance, if a husband's refusal to provide for his wife and family is not in fact desertion. Doesn't this text require us to ask that? If a husband's refusal to provide for his family is not, in fact, desertion, how should the church respond if a woman complained that her husband was content with his unemployment checks and was no longer even going to be looking for work? How should the church respond if after marriage, a husband treacherously decided that he was no longer interested in sex or refused to have children? How should the church respond to a situation like that? Should the church view those treacherous decisions on the part of a husband after marriage as being, in fact, a form of desertion? Is that a form of desertion? Well, I know how the Puritans would have handled a case like that, because I know how they did handle a case like that. Leland Ryken, in a very interesting book about the Puritans entitled Worldly Saints, it's a great read, Worldly Saints by Leland Ryken. He says this on page 39. The Puritans, as we all know, were sexually inhibited and repressive. In other words, that's what you were told. That's what we were told in school, that the Puritans were all sexually inhibited and repressive. Or were they? And of course they weren't. And Dr. Renahan has told us that the reason that they wore black is because that's the color of the rich and of the prosperous, not because they were of a background, you know, that was doer or, you know, just upset at the very notion that somebody might be having fun somewhere. Okay, that's the common picture of the Puritans, but that isn't what they were. Listen to what Leland Ryken says. The Puritans, as we all know, were sexually inhibited and repressive, or were they? When a New England wife complained first to her pastor and then to the whole congregation that her husband was neglecting their sex life, the church proceeded to excommunicate the man. Isn't that interesting? The church proceeded to excommunicate the man. Why would the church do that? The church would do that because they deemed that treacherous act on the part of a husband to be a form of desertion. And here in this law, what was required of this man? What was required of the man was that even for a bondservant, a female bondservant, she had to be provided with food, she had to be provided with raiment, and she had to be provided with time, conjugal time. And if he refused these things, then she had the right to go out. And this is a divorce. She was a free woman. They were no longer married. Here then was a law designed to prevent injustice and to guarantee even a purchased wife her rights to a secure place in the family. And so that's a text that's not often looked at. But the very phraseology, go out, is used in other portions of the scriptures to speak clearly of a divorce. When she went out, she was no longer the wife of this man. And even though there is no mention specifically in the text of a bill of divorcement being given to her, as Deuteronomy 24 says, what reason do we have to even remotely think that a bill of divorcement wasn't given to her? Because that was also part of God's holy law. So if a man treacherously decided after marriage that these basic things would not be provided, then the woman had the liberty and the right to go out. Now consider in the third place what we learn from the law regarding captured women. What do we learn from the law regarding captured women? And here it's Deuteronomy 21 and verses 10 through 14. Deuteronomy 21, 10 through 14. You know, in fact, there's been some humorous things written by some very, very good theologians in the past year or so that I've seen even on Facebook to try to deal with the one particular model of getting a wife that is so popular in homeschool movements and all the rest of it. That is, you know, the one model, that of courtship. And some of our pretty good minds have said, listen, the Bible gives all kinds of ways to get a wife and not just the courtship way. And here's one of them, the capture way. The capture way. Deuteronomy 21, 10 through 14. When you go out to battle against your enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands, and you take them away captive, and see among the captives a beautiful woman, and have a desire for her, and would take her as a wife for yourself, then you shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and trim her nails. She shall also remove the clothes of her captivity, and shall remain in your house, and mourn her father and mother a full month. And after that, you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. If it shall be, if you are not pleased with her, then you shall let her go wherever she wishes. But you shall certainly not sell her for money. You shall not mistreat her because you have humbled her. Here's a clear effect of the fall. Here's warfare. Here's battle and all the terrible disruptions that warfare and battle causes in the lives of people and families. Here's a law regarding POWs, if you will. Matthew Henry said this about this judicial law. By this law, a soldier is allowed to marry his captive if he pleased. For the hardness of their hearts, Moses gave them this permission. lest if they had not the liberty given them to marry such, they should have taken liberty to defile themselves with them, and by such wickedness the camp would have been troubled. In other words, we're learning here that here's another law that's regulating something that's going to happen. And, of course, in conquering armies, what do we find? We have rape. We find rape and pillage. This says no. Marry. It regulates a practice. Now, these regulations were designed to prevent ill treatment of captives, and we ought to note the particulars. One, she was given a month to adjust to her new situation. That was prior to consummation of the relationship. She was given a month to adjust to her new situation. This prevented hastiness, allowing time to evaluate his original decision to take this woman. Number two, if after marriage the husband was displeased with her, she was allowed to leave, to go wherever she wished. She could not be sold or enslaved. She was to be let go, and this too was a divorce. That divorce, that is the dissolution of a marriage, was allowed in Israel is clear from many, many texts. I don't know any competent scholar that says that divorce was disallowed in Israel and was not practiced in Israel. In Leviticus 21:7, Leviticus 21:14, 22:13, all kinds of Old Testament texts, we learn that divorce was a reality in Israel. The only men prohibited from marrying a divorced woman were Israel's priests. The only men in Israel that were prohibited from marrying a divorced woman was Israel's priests. That meant that if you were just anybody other than a priest, you had a right to marry a woman that was divorced. Look with me, please, at Leviticus 21:7, and this ought to prove the reality of divorce within Israel and the regulation of divorce within Israel. Leviticus 21:7 says this of the priests. They, that is the priests, shall not take a woman who is profaned by harlotry, nor shall they take a woman divorced from her husband, for he is holy to his God. Verse 14, a widow or a divorced woman, or one who is profaned by harlotry, these he may not take, but rather he is to marry a virgin of his own people. Now that implies that other men were allowed to. Other men were allowed to marry a divorced woman. There was the reality of divorce within Israel. Jay Adams has said this. Contrary to some opinions, the concept of divorce is biblical. The Bible recognizes and regulates divorce. This must be affirmed clearly and without hesitation. So divorce, then, was more than separation. It ended a marriage. That only priests were forbidden to marry a divorcee proves that her previous marriage was dissolved, and other men were allowed to marry her without incurring any guilt. Both divorce and death ended a marriage, as far as the Old Testament law was concerned. Divorce ended a marriage, death ended a marriage. And I might say, looking at it from the perspective of the 21st century, this was an advancement over the beliefs of pagans. Because even into the 19th century, Hindus in India were still burning alive a man's deceased widow, a deceased man's widow, because the Hindus believed that marriage continues after death. And so they wanted to guarantee that he still had a wife after death, and they killed her by burning her alive. And when Christian missionaries came to India, they were the ones largely responsible for overturning that horrific practice in India. The only ones that I can think of here in America that still believe that marriage continues after death are the crazy Mormons, with their view of, quote, sealed marriages. And but the scriptures, I can't help it, folks. I can't help being direct. All right. But anyway, but divorce ends a marriage and death ends a marriage. And the Old Testament scriptures are clear in this. In Israel, then, both death and divorce ended a marriage. Charles Hodge, in his Systematic Theology, wrote this: divorce is not a mere separation. This is volume 3, page 391. A great short treatment of the subject of divorce by Charles Hodge under the heading of the Seventh Commandment. Divorce is not a mere separation, whether temporary or permanent. It is not such a separation as leaves the parties in the relation of husband and wife and simply relieves them from the obligation of their relative duties. Divorce annuls the marriage so that the parties are no longer man and wife. They stand henceforth to each other in the same relation as they were before marriage. That this is the true idea of divorce is plain from the fact that under the old dispensation, if a man put away his wife, she was at liberty to marry again. And this, of course, supposes that the marriage relation to her former husband was effectually dissolved. So those are two of the judicial laws that do speak to this issue and often are overlooked in any consideration of them. But we must not overlook them, because the Old Testament judicial law teaches us principles of general equity that we are to think about. Any issue of ethics is one that eventually leads to complex cases. And there are those who teach that there's no divorce and no remarriage for any reason. And you know what they do? They redefine our marriage vows. Now, when I married Deb many years ago in 1974, I made vows to her that I would be faithful to her in sickness and in health, for richer or poorer, for better or for worse. Well, let me ask you, when you made those vows, and probably everybody that's married here has made those vows or something similar, for better or for worse, did you even contemplate that under the heading of worse was criminal activity on the part of your spouse? That ever get into your, did you ever think of that category? Criminal activity on the part of your spouse. Did you ever think of adultery as part of the worst? Well, I didn't. I didn't think of that. What comes to my mind, rightly so, is that worse covers things like what? Sickness, disease, accidents, bereavement. All those things. When I said in sickness and in health, for better or for worse, I meant that if my wife got into an accident and became a paraplegic, I wouldn't divorce her and I'd care for her for the rest of my days. That's what I meant by worse. But there are those that are teaching that worse means if your spouse commits murder and is sent to jail for life, you don't have the liberty to ever divorce. If your spouse commits adultery, that your vow of for better or for worse covers her adultery and you can never remarry. And I say, are you guys nuts? The church has never understood for better or worse to mean those things. It has never understood it to mean those things. And in the Old Testament, then, we have these case laws. We have these judicial laws that said even for a captive wife, she had rights. And even for a bondservant, a female bondservant, she had rights. And if these rights were not given to her, they had the right to go out, to be divorced. Now, consider in the last place the pivotal passage of the Sinai Covenant on divorce and remarriage. And it is, of course, Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. And this is the pivotal passage because this is the one that was debated in the Gospels between the Pharisees and Christ. And here's what we read. Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, And he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out from his house. And she leaves his house and goes and becomes another man's wife. And if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of the house, or if the latter husband dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband, who sent her away, is not allowed to take her again to be his wife, since she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. Now, I want to try to open up the text, and very simply, in the first place, observe the structure of the text. Verses 1 through 3 is always referred to as the protasis, P-R-O-T-A-S-I-S, the protasis, or the conditional part of the sentence. Verse 4 is called the apodosis, A-P-O-D-O-S-I-S, or the consequence or conclusion. That's how the text is structured. Now, consider what Moses is doing here in this law. First of all, Moses is not commanding divorce. He is regulating divorce. Divorce is already a reality. The practice was going on, and now there is new regulation about it. Secondly, he is forbidding the remarriage only of those who were married to each other in a prior marriage. That's what he's doing. He's forbidding the remarriage only of those who were married to each other in a prior marriage if another man has had her as his wife. And thirdly, consider the vague terminology of the text. That the terminology is vague is demonstrated by the fact that it was argued over among the Jews both up to and through Jesus' day. There are two Hebrew words translated herein as the New American Standard or the ESV translates it as some indecency. A husband has found, quote, some indecency in this wife. In the King James Version, it's translated as, quote, some uncleanness. In the New International Version, it's translated as something indecent. Now, these are very vague terms. And the fact that this was the text that was argued, so that you had two main schools of thought about this text, even in Jesus' day, indicates that you've got these rabbis who knew their Hebrew, who are still saying we're of two great schools of thought on what some indecency means. Now, the terms are irvath debar. And irvath commonly means nakedness. And debar as something. We learn that many say that it literally says the nakedness of the thing. And that helps us very little. What in the world does he mean? What is meant here by some indecency? And when we take into account the fact that the only other time this phrase is used in the Old Testament, irvath debar, is in Deuteronomy 23:14, and there it refers to uncovered excrement. And this is something that always bugged me when I backpacked. You're on some trail, you're walking along, and some previous backpacker is just gone right there off the trail. And there's this toilet paper and this pile of excrement, and you just can't help but say, are you kidding me? You couldn't bury it? What do you think I carry a trowel for in my pack? And this is how the phrase is used in Deuteronomy 23:12-14. Irvath debar there means uncovered excrement. Well, that helps us in Deuteronomy 24, doesn't it? Well, no, not at all. It doesn't help us at all. What in the world does something indecent mean here in Deuteronomy 24? It doesn't help us at all. Very little can be determined by a study of the terminology. That the rabbis differed so widely as to its meaning in Jesus' day should prove this. So we're not going to learn a lot from the Hebrew words, because they're as vague as the English words. Something indecent. But the context is that, okay, a husband has found something he really doesn't like about his wife. And he said, this is it. I've had it. I want out. And so what does Moses do to regulate the practice of divorce? Well, he tells us that the man has to give her a certificate of divorce, a piece of paper, a legal piece of paper, a certificate of divorce that she takes in her hand, she has for her records, and she is now at liberty to marry another man. Consider now the positive benefits of these regulations. Number one, first of all, they protected the woman. With her certificate of divorce in hand, a sad page had been turned. A chapter in her life was ended. The marriage was over. She no longer had any marital responsibilities towards her former husband. She could get on with life and begin a new chapter. She could remarry, and she was protected from any charge of unfaithfulness because she had this certificate of divorce in her hand. An adulterer would not have been protected in this way. But she had now this legal paper in hand, and she was free to remarry. The only man she couldn't remarry was a priest in Israel. Secondly, by making divorce legal and official, all the vagueness of a mere de facto separation was dispelled. This is not now a mere de facto separation. This is now a legal proceeding. Moses is regulating a practice already being practiced. By making divorce legal and official, all the vagueness of a mere de facto divorce or separation were dispelled. And thirdly, by forbidding remarriage to a former divorced spouse, if an intervening marriage had occurred, a man was given pause to ask if he wanted to pursue such an irrevocable action. If you were required to put a certificate of divorce in her hand, and you knew that if she went out and married somebody else, there was no way you were ever going to have her as your wife again. That would give a man pause to say, do I really want to go through with this? It would prevent hastiness, wouldn't it? And so this then was the law with regard to Deuteronomy chapter 24. And this then is divorce and remarriage under the